It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
On today's show, we speak with Natasha Leonard, author of the new book, Being Numerous, Essays on Non-Fascist Life, a collection of writings that touch on both the personal and the political, while discussing social movements and struggles from Black Lives Matter to Standing Rock, the J20, and beyond. The book asks the fundamental question, what does it mean to live a non-fascist life? And also calls into question the heart of liberalism's false opposition to capital, white supremacy, and the state. Natasha Leonard has written for a variety of publications, including the New York Times and The Nation, and currently edits a column at The Intercept, and is involved in the new autonomous anti-capitalist publication, Commune. Natasha, we welcome you to the show. Please introduce yourself and the book.
So I'm Natasha Leonard, and I'm the author of Being Numerous, Essays on Non-Fascist Life, which came out with Verso Books this year.
So I was watching an interview that's from a couple years ago of you on Democracy Now!, and at one point in your life, this is interesting, I just learned this, you worked at for the New York Times doing freelance, which I think some people listening to this might be surprised about because they know you from your work at like The Intercept and other outlets. But you wrote an article that appeared in Salon, this is around the time of the Occupy movement, entitled Why I Quit the Mainstream Media. So to start us off, can you tell us about your experience in the mainstream media and also like what drove you to break with it?
Yeah, sure. It's a sort of funny story that ended up being, I guess, the kind of beginning of my career as it looks now. But I had come to New York to go to journalism school just because I didn't want to do the thing I was doing in England. And then while I was there, I did like interning for the Times and then was writing for them as a stringer. So just a freelancer, no contract, no anything like that. So not like an employee. When Occupy kind of began and started getting small amounts of attention, I was already involved. Like, I had been at pre-planning meetings. I definitely didn't have a purely journalistic relationship with it at any point. But that also meant that, you know, I was around a lot. And so when I was able to just give basic reports to the Times, just, you know, very kind of bare bones stuff as a stringer. And then the day that, the Brooklyn Bridge was blocked and there were 750 around protesters arrested in the middle of the bridge, and I was actually among them, so it became this kind of thing, like New York Times reporter arrested at Occupy, and I wrote a short thing about that, and then quite soon after I was on a panel at Blue Stockings Bookshop, which is a leftist bookshop in New York, that was hosted by Jacobin, I think, the kind of social democrat magazine. And it was pretty clear in that talk that, you know, I had a vested interest in Occupy, not a detached one. And the video of the talk was online, obviously, and I knew that. But some people from Breitbart lost their minds over it and were like, oh my God, New York Times journalist. The New York Times is behind Occupy. It's Soros and the New York Times. We knew it all along. And then there became this sort of furor, which really I found quite unsurprising, but also hilarious. So that was this kind of prompt to be like, Yes, correct. I'm not an objective journalist, nor do I want to be. And I was only about 22 at the time, so no, a little older, 24. So it was all quite new to me. But I didn't, you know, it's not like I spent many years in the kind of beat reporting, purported objectivity minds. Like, this was the beginning of my career, and from then on, have pretty much just done, you know, my own brand of journalism. Come advocacy, come propaganda stuff. And and the other funny thing that came of that is that Steve Bannon made a movie around that time called Occupy Unmasked. Which was, yeah, I don't know if you guys remember, it was just appalling, and like obviously reliably conspiracy theory filled. And it began with this suggestion that, like, me, the New York Times, my friend Malcolm Harris, the writer, who was also on this panel with me, that we, you know, we were behind this conspiracy with the powers that be, the elite powers, and then, you know, sort of forget about this Bannon guy, and, you know, 5-6 years later, boom, Steve Bannon in the White House. So, yeah, it's a funny history. In a way,
it's very strange because, I mean, obviously, look at a lot of the people that have been involved at Breitbart. I mean, they are very much involved with a lot of like far right movements. I mean, obviously, Milo is one example, but I feel like what they do is much different. I mean, they're trying to like maliciously kind of like massage certain ideas into their framework, where I think it's much different than, you know, people involved in social movements, like being involved in social movements and also being like a journalist and writing. I mean, I think you can have integrity and also have politics.
Right, like the sort of stenographer. And, you know, that's media commentators and theorists have challenged that kind of myth for a long time, this kind of notion of the view from nowhere, as if there can ever be such a thing. So I think once you let go of the possibility of a kind of subject-free storytelling, you kind of have to consider, you know, the most, for oneself, the most ethical approach. And for me, it's sort of being transparent about the politics I have and the world that I want to build and the kind of consensus truths I hope that we can share, which are obviously political ones, and that's a political thing to do. So, yeah, I never feel pernicious or that, like, I kind of cross some problematic ethical boundaries by being a leftist journalist. I think it's, you know, well, I wouldn't be a journalist at all if that wasn't the kind of journalism I would be able to do.
What would you say has changed since Occupy and kind of the post-Occupy period of writing about social movements and politics? And how would you compare that now to under Trump? So kind of like going from like this neoliberal Obama era to now under Trump. Is it the same pretty much, or is it very different?
I mean, it's very different with kind of through lines throughout. And there's obviously so much has happened in different ways in those intermediate years. I definitely won't do justice to all the, you know, different movements that have emerged and kind of garnered solidarities and, you know, first and foremost to talk about Black Lives Matter, and the necessary uprisings there that obviously happened in those intervening years. And I think made very clear, at least to me, how one of the failures of Occupy was definitely not putting issues of racism at front and center in this class struggle. So I think that was something that we all have to kind of learn from and not repeat in any sort of social struggle. You know, and then the things that are continuities, I think for a while after Occupy, I think I spent a few years feeling a little embarrassed about it because of, like, there were some silly aspects, right? And all these things have their limits and make their mistakes and, you know, fail and then fail better. But now with a slightly, like, longer view, I'm more appreciative of the kind of direct action, taking up space and the kind of the shifts that it did make and the political bonds built that have remained and kind of gone into different projects. And I think it's worth, in terms of the legacy of Occupy, people often talk about, you know, so the debt collective, that was kind of birthed in Occupy, and now there's, you know, presidential would-be platforms about cancellation of student debt and cancellation of medical debt. Great. And people talk about shifting the discourse to finally talk about inequality, and credit Occupy with a lot of that. And that's all true, and I think that's important. But I don't want, in that kind of historicization of it, to miss that, no, that there was also a really important tactical set of interventions and taking up of street space and disruption. And that was really radical, and experiments in direct democracy. So I don't want a higher legacy to just be, we changed the conversation so we can have, you know, better democratic presidential candidate platforms. Because I think that wouldn't do justice to the more radical elements that really formed that moment. In terms of the shifts from, you know, the Obama presidency to the Trump presidency, in terms of media, obviously it's been incredibly irritating for so much of the kind of liberal landscape, well, liberal to conservative altogether, to have this, you know, nostalgia for the halcyon days of like November 2016, especially considering that, you know, uprisings for Black life all happened under Obama, this idea of, you know, if only we could go back to the good old days is an obviously like vile and privileged one, and one I think that often finds its problems with Trump not in the fact of his being an escalation and emboldening of existing fascistic tendencies and apparatus in the US, which is what I think the problem is, but disliking his uncouthness, his grossness, his barbarism, as if they'd prefer their fascistic statecraft sort of politer and with better spelling. So that's been obviously an annoying thing to contend with, and a really problematic misreading of this history and how, you know, the neoliberal presumptions and standards leading up to Trump definitely birthed that. You know, Trump was not birthed as an aberration. It, both Trump, Brexit, all the various shifts to the far right that we're seeing were birthed of capitalism. They're not an aberration to it. And that's always true of modernity and fascism. That's, you know, that's not a new thing. So I think it's irritating that in, like, reminding people of those narratives has to be part of the work we do now as well.
So I'm just curious, like, what kind of made you want to put the book together?
It's actually one of those like very boring reasons. My friend at Verso asked me if I wanted to make an essay collection. So Verso being the publisher, and they're probably like the largest. I think they are the largest radical publishers in Europe and the US together. So the reason I did it is because I was asked and I said yes. So then the question was sort of which essays and how they kind of fit together. And it was a little bit of a kind of mishmash, but I definitely wanted there to be a through line of trying to pick apart the assumptions of like liberal centrism, which is its own conservatism, and trying to do that from different angles, both looking at debates around social movements like the uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore, like the punishment of water protectors in Standing Rock, but also the kind of problematic kind of religious metaphysics of liberalism that then also enables so much, in my mind, so much kind of fascism. So in order to give a defense of, say, anti-fascist tactics, which is one of the kind of main pushes in my book, and for kind of often decried modes of protest, radical forms of protest, I felt the need to give kind of a philosophical defense of these things, which I had done in various essays. And so bringing those together, updating them, was kind of made sense to me. And then, that was kind of the genesis of it. It wasn't like some sort of epiphany that I was like, these essays have to all come together and they make perfect sense together. I'm not entirely sure they do all make sense together. Like, there's one at the very end about suicide, because I have had two suicide attempts in my adult life, and, you know, involvement with mental illness and abuse and things like this. And it's not obviously clear what that has to do with living a non-fascist life, but I think issues about how we think of intention, personhood, selfhood, sovereignty, personal sovereignty, they kind of, it's a bit of a stretch to fit it in, but I wanted to, so I did, because it's my book. But on the whole, yeah, it was a little bit of a kind of post hoc gathering, and a lot of the essays were pre-published in places that don't often get huge readership. Not that Verso books necessarily do either, but magazines like The New Inquiry, the journal Logic, and Real Life online magazine, places that, you know, you can have more of you can really go for it radically and intellectually, but don't always get as many shares as like a short Intercept column that I do.
Just as an aside, I mean, I think, you know, this is something that we've talked about. It's going down kind of like amongst ourselves. But, I mean, it's exciting to see you and people like Kim Kelly or like Zoe, like other people, like really become rising stars in a lot of ways, like as like new journalists. Like, do you still think you'll have all the opportunities to kind of shine if a Democrat comes in? Or is this in part because like Trump's in office?
You know what, it's one I haven't thought about, but actually, funnily enough, I don't think this is actually about Trump, that those apertures for left voices getting at least some purchase in mainstream publications, you know, beyond the kind of left-leaning ones, but also kind of opening up more left-leaning media spaces. I think almost it's counterintuitive that it's happening now, because there's, you know, in the media there's such a kind of hunkering down into liberalism as opposed to leftism in response to Trump. But actually, I think the ability to have kind of more leftist spaces, I think that was more just a slow build, actually. So a lot of journalists who did find each other during Occupy made magazines, started their careers in various media institutions, and now this many years later, maybe some of them are, you know, some of my best friends are editors, and they're able to open up more and more of those spaces, and an interest in those kind of leftist ideas, also reflecting, the power and the strength of a lot of movements who have kind of enforced that the public listen and care, at least to an extent, about workers' struggles, about feminist struggle, about challenging techno-capital's hegemony. I think, you know, this, the fact that there's journalism happening around it is as much to do with the fact of movements making themselves unavoidable, and that's great.
We're going to talk more about kind of the critique of liberalism in a second, but one of the things that you stated in, there was a book release that Verso did, and he gave a talk about the book, which is great. We'll put that in the show notes for this. It's on YouTube. But you said that you didn't want to really write a book about Antifa, but as you said, like a large part of this is about talking about anti-fascism, and obviously like a non-fascist life is in the title. So I'm just curious if you can explain like that aspect of it, like kind of like the anti-fascist bent to it and kind of like what that means.
Sure. So, I mean, in their book's first essay, I talk directly about Antifa and Antifa tactics and why they make sense as a correct intervention against the rising far right. But what I mean when I say it's not just a book about Antifa, because it isn't, is if you're going to think about fascism seriously, I think you have to think of it quite capaciously and quite broadly as something that is born of fascistic habits, tendencies, collectivities that already permeate and have permeated so much of life under capitalism and all its violent hierarchies. So if you're going to talk about anti-fascism, the first step is to realize, you know, society was not already anti-fascist enough before the current rise of the far right. And I think you can see this sense that that was the assumption. So around Trump's ascendance, there was, you know, this basically a cottage industry in the media of people writing about, is Trump a fascist? Could he be a fascist? No, he's not a fascist because he doesn't have a militia. Oh, he reminds me of Mussolini. This, you know, all about the question of Trump's or Trumpist fascism. And what I realized in all of this media, whether it was saying he was or wasn't a fascist, was the assumption that the writers themselves and the world they were living in was anti-fascist enough. Fascism was some awful threat that could come back, had been destroyed in 1945, but could come back, as opposed to something that constantly, in various forms, seeps in and bubbles up. So that was a sort of intervention I wanted to make to talk about fascism pretty broadly. So then to talk about anti-fascism pretty broadly, and, you know, the ways in which it's very difficult to be purely anti-fascist, because the best you can sort of do is anti-fascisting, and think of it more like practices and actions and habits as opposed to identities. So that's why the book can talk about Standing Rock and obviously be talking about non-fascist, anti-fascist practice, even though during the camps and the uprising there, people weren't really using the F word and talking about fascism, but they could well have. And I think in this context, it's worth not just looking back on those struggles and those ongoing struggles and seeing how they connect to and are anti-fascist, even if they might not be anti-fa.
Well, moving forward, I think the other really interesting bit of the book is its attack on kind of the liberal worldview. And I'm just curious, you know, now that we've seen 3 years under Trump, what are your thoughts on just the inability of liberals really to offer anything of substance, either in like tangibly pushing back against Trump or just critiquing what's going on? I'm just curious, like, your thoughts, like, a decade from now, when, like, we look back on this time period, what do you think that we will think about in terms of, like, hashtag the resistance and just kind of the milquetoast liberals?
I mean, I think we'll probably be thinking quite similarly to how we do now, quite, like, angrily and dismissively about the position so many of these, like, hashtag resistance figures take, which seems to be more interest in civility than justice. And that's obviously nothing new. That's been the position of centrist liberals, you know, the very people that Martin Luther King decried as the white moderates, more invested in order than justice in his letter from Birmingham. So I think we'll have a similar critique of the moderates now as, you know, those bystanders that we look at, and those who, hindered struggle then, by their demands for moderation and civility. I think we'll have the same critique and already do of the liberals demanding that now. And I also think you'll see, I mean, for example, a good example this week is, Ellen DeGeneres, getting in trouble online, rightfully, because there was a picture of her at a sports game. I think it was a football game. I don't know. Sitting at in the box with George Bush, and then on her show saying, "Look, this is a time that we need kindness, and George is my friend, and he shouldn't not be my friend just because he's a Republican and a conservative." And obviously, rightly, so many people responded, he's a war criminal responsible for mass murder, decimation of vast, vast, vast numbers of innocent people, torture, all on his watch and under his command. So this idea of the kind of open-hearted, liberal acceptance basically just means tolerance for the intolerable. I think that's all. It's angering, and often relates to class interests. I mean, Ellen DeGeneres has the same class interests as George W. Bush, and so I think having a kind of keen eye on those sort of things is obviously important. But I think for people that have been involved in leftist movements for some time, I'm not at all surprised by this, because we had the same liberal voices decrying Occupy activists for not behaving well or for property damage, the decrial of the people involved in the uprisings in Ferguson for destroying their own community and being non-peaceful, was coming from those same, liberal and conservative, incredibly patronizing and problematic voices.
Well, the book itself touches several times on the J20, both in terms of the protests that happened during Trump's inauguration, but also the subsequent trial. I'm just curious, looking back on the case now, what's your larger takeaways from the entire affair?
It was a nightmare for the defendants who had to go through this, even though the charges ended up being dropped, and it was obviously a completely bunk case. But it was evidence again that even if the state isn't able to kind of get its conviction and win, those kind of juridical disruptions can really, really harm movements and leave people traumatized and afraid and feeling like they can't get involved in politics in that way again. So that, I think, that we've got evidence of that, and that's really sad to see. Also, I know that a number of former J20 defendants from Arizona have been facing felony riot charges again for being involved in an anti-ICE action there. That's awful to have to go through that twice, and in both cases for, really righteous protest. In a broader context, it's interesting. Like, you don't, aside from amongst leftists, like, you don't hear about the J20 protests that much. Like, they were kind of swallowed into other narratives about inauguration protests, the Women's March. That's, I guess, interesting to me. It's maybe a boon insofar as you don't have lots and lots of voices weighing in and decrying the act of the very naughty black bloc. But I do think at the times when it was discussed, it was important at least to make clear that block was an anti-fascist one and worth defending. But what I write about in the book, one essay is really just about, which was originally published in The Nation, and was just about the J20 arrests and what it was doing to the defendants and the toll of that and the absurdity of the nature of felony riot charges. And in that essay, I very much use this language of rights and how this arrest and these prosecutions were a violation of First Amendment rights. And then in the essay, I write a kind of follow-up in this kind of about-face to question the limitations of that sort of rights language, which obviously, when you're dealing with the state, you kind of have to use, but it is a state discourse. Rights don't, there's no pre-political essential rights that we all just get to carry around. States have to bestow humans as like right bearers, people they recognize as having rights. And this is a point Hannah Arendt made with regards to refugees. I mean, it's empty words to say, but human rights, when someone has been so excluded from the communities that are bestowed rights and recognized to have them, to even have the right to have rights. So I think we always have to keep a critical eye on when we use a rights discourse, what we're doing when we do that, and its limitations. So obviously, if you're in court and your First Amendment rights have been violated, don't bring up your intellectual critique of rights and your state critiques. Use the rights that you have or should have to get yourself free. But then in a broader narrative, what we have rights to do shouldn't be the limits of how we think about how we politically engage. There's no right to punch Richard Spencer, quite the opposite, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. In fact, I think it's a good thing to punch neo-Nazis. So part of the book is reportage, and part of it is a critique, which is both a media critique and a political critique, of the language we kind of find ourselves having to use when we're in certain circumstances, both certain publishing circumstances, but then also in certain relations to the state, and how the state overdetermines the sort of discourse we're allowed to use when demanding and fighting for our freedoms.
Yeah, I remember the article that you're talking about in The Nation. That was a great piece.
Thanks.
A lot of people were like, oh my God, I can't believe this is in The Nation.
Yeah, it was funny because I wrote that right because Richard Spencer got punched on inauguration afternoon. And it was this, silver lining on an otherwise really upsetting day in so many reasons, both the fact of President Trump and the mass arrest of around 300 anti-fascist protesters, if not more, and then, who were comrades. And then, there's this glorious punch making its rounds all over YouTube, and it's got, Bruce Springsteen backing tracks and Katy Perry backing tracks. And so I kind of wrote, and this idea sort of informs other aspects of the essay too. And what I was just talking about the so many people's presumptions that they are, just by virtue of being born after 1945, anti-fascist enough. So I kind of presumed that punching a neo-Nazi, just, one swift, elegant punch, he stumbles away, no one's hospitalized. This isn't even it's not a beating, it's a punch to a truly violent ideologue who was taking up camera space, was going to project his message further. I just presumed that that even liberals in this time, liberals who'd been going on and on about the threat of fascism in the lead up to Trump's inauguration, I just thought, didn't think talking about and celebrating a neo-Nazi getting punched in the face would cause such a furore. And that was obviously, you know, my poor perceptions, my ill thinking, because yeah, there was a lot of pushback and the nation felt the need. And I have, like, you know, my current editor and my editor then at the Nation are really awesome people, but the kind of broader institution, they felt the need to publish another opinion piece by someone else who thought the violent punch was a very, very bad thing. And, you know, the classic, like, they go low, we should go high, Michelle Obama line, which, you know, fails to understand the reason why anti-fascist counter-violence, as I call it, because the violence exists in the fascism in the first place, the counter-violence, it's not because people love punching or because they want it. It's because there are only certain things that break up and make fascist collectivities intolerable, and you do want to make it intolerable. You want to make it intolerable for Richard Spencer to go out and talk to cameras because he knows he's going to get punched or milkshaked. And these tactics, you know, they work. And it doesn't always have to be a physical confrontation. There can be, you know, big group, mass, direct and uncomfortable protesting, not letting someone who's a fascist sit down for dinner in peace. I think all these tactics are really valuable and have, you know, some empirical successes over the decades. And so I was, you know, and we're talking about an abject neo-Nazi, and one singular punch upset so many liberals who then don't understand anti-fascist tactics as actually tactical, not exactly thoughtless violence. This is thoughtful. And also, I think is those kind of criticisms are really based on a failure to understand where real violence is located, which is obviously in white nationalist, white supremacist ideology. That is violence, genocidal violence.
Yeah, there's actually a really great Richard Spencer quote on a recent podcast he's been doing that you can watch on YouTube, where he literally says, "We were afraid to go out in public," and he's talking about the time kind of between the punch and, you know, up till now, basically.
Yeah, and he canceled his college tour and blamed Antifa.
Yeah, I mean, his more recent stuff, I mean, he's being very explicit. He said, look, like, the alt-right, as we knew it, is over. Like, we're not interested in going out in public anymore. Like, we're trying to rebuild ourselves. I mean, that's why they tried to do the whole, like, let's fall around Andrew Yang. But, I mean, he's very explicit. And, like, the other people that are on his podcast, like, two or three other dudes are all, like, in agreement that, like, the alt-right is not interested in trying to organize in real life anymore. I mean, obviously, you still have groups like Identity Europa and Patriot Front that are, like, putting up stickers and stuff, but, I mean, that's essentially where they're relegated to, and people are, you know, mobilizing against them still and doxing them and taking down their stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And obviously, like, you know, that doesn't... These groups, these terrible people, they are just, like, you know, a pinnacle on the white supremacist mountain. At no point does anyone I know who's invested in anti-fascist work think for a second that just if you make the alt-right, which is already kind of a fumbling set of idiocies, that sort of breaking those groups apart is sufficient. Obviously, we have an fascist white supremacist in the White House, but obviously those kind of violent patriarchal white supremacist gangs shouldn't be allowed to gain space and organize, especially in university campuses, which is where a lot of their energies were put. I think, yeah, making it both online and offline, creating material consequences for that kind of organizing that is Antifa. That is anti-fascist strategy. And it works. And I wish that was more appreciated.
In regards to the pushback that you got from the Richard Spencer being punched article, Would you say that there are other things that that you've noticed, you know, the wall in terms of like what's acceptable supposedly even for like a lefty journalist to write about?
Huh, it's a good question. I mean, I know that, I mean, we mentioned Kim earlier, and I know that, you know, it's amazing, and I'm so pleased that she has a Teen Vogue column, and I think now a New Republic column too, but she had had a long-term relationship as a freelancer, I believe, with NPR, who dropped her contract because of basically right-wing trolls, which is very, right, the worst of trolls. What a horrible gremlin. And so that's awful. And so you do see how the consequences that can have on, you know, really excellent journalists. I've not had too much trouble, honestly. There's a funny feedback loop. I've been doing the work I do for various publications long enough that it's not self-censorship, but I kind of know where I can put what I can put where. So I know that, you know, I can be pretty clear on my politics for The Intercept, but, you know, wouldn't necessarily do a deep dive into the philosophy of those politics there. And nor would I, you know, I've been able and can defend anti-fascist activists, you know, regardless of their, you know, if their tactics involve physical confrontation. So that's not been a problem. And same in terms of defending sex workers' rights and some of the, you know, the issues that sometimes you do see liberal and even left liberal spaces get problematic about. I've been lucky with that, but you know, we'll see. I'm sure there's some lines I'll stumble across soon.
How do you feel like the growth of the far right media world has impacted wider journalism, if at all?
Right, yeah. So I think a lot of the way the alt-right has become a subject of media attention has not been good at all. And that's just them as, like, object. So I think there's been classic examples as, like, the dapper Nazi New York Times profile of Spencer. I mean, I personally didn't agree when Laurie Penny, who's a leftist journalist who I care for as a human and a writer, I really disagreed with her and let her know that when she went on the bus with Milo and his supporters. I considered that a line that I personally wouldn't cross. And, you know, wasn't nearly as problematic as some of the weird apologia features you've seen that kind of are in the guise of, oh, we're just trying to understand the far right. And you get, you know, a neo-Nazi presented as a sweet boy next door. I do also think that I think it's been very revealing of the ideological positioning of a lot of the major mainstream publications in terms of their opinion sections. So the New York Times, perfect example, in its sort of panic after Trump's election to disavow this notion that they're liberal and that they have, you know, they do include a diversity of opinions, instead of actually doing that, they just allowed a far greater number of incredibly reactionary conservative voices to join the opinion roster. I mean, Barry Weiss, Bret Stephens, just awful, deeply reactionary voices. And this is supposed to be the opinion diversity, but you see occasional leftist piece, and Charlie Blow's pretty good, for example, and Michelle Alexander when she writes, but you know, you don't have nearly the balance of, you know, the actual left compared to the huge purchase the right and the far right's been able to gain from this liberal anxiety around, like, two-sidesism. And I think a really troubling statistic around that that I like let repeat quite often is that in the month after Charlottesville, and I got Adam Johnson found this, calculated this. In the month after Charlottesville, the six major broadsheets in the US published, I believe it was 26 articles about the terrible rise of the far right, 27 about the risks of the far or so-called alt left. And this is after, you know, a leftist activist is murdered and Nazis are chanting blood and soil, carrying tiki torches. So this, you know, that to me is a true exposure of where so many of these publications really stand. Which doesn't mean that you don't get the occasional and, you know, thankfully so, good, both reported and commentary pieces in those places, but, like, essentially, institutionally, they are conservative.
There's a chapter in the book entitled Riots for Black Life, and I'm just curious if you can just kind of get into that chapter.
Sure. So that chapter is, kind of looks at, largely the media and popular responses to the uprisings in Ferguson, Baltimore, and then also a couple of years before that, when there were riots in London after a young black man was killed unarmed by the British, by the London police. And there was obviously just so much decrial of property damage, the argument that looting is some apolitical mindless act, as opposed to, you know, a quite reasonable and indeed political response to mass violence, execution, and the violence of the way property is organized around race and class, in both London and in the various sites of America that I was talking about. And there's this really constant thing that you see in media reports, even ones that aren't really trying to weigh in, about incidents and events like this. They'll be like, you know, there was a vigil for Mike Brown, and then the protesters or protest turned violent. And I'm really, and you see the term turned violent all the time, and I'm really critical of this idea of this violent turn, because I think what it misses, and this is what I mean by mislocating violence, is that it couldn't turn to violence because the situation that we're talking about is a violent one. There is always a background violence when someone like Mike Brown can get executed the way he was. When people have to demand that Black Lives Matter and that be recognized, that is an existing state of violence. There is no non-violence to find when that is true. So to demand non-violence, I find kind of rich and disgraceful, because I'm sorry, I don't see peace here. I don't see peace when the police can, with impunity, execute poor people of color and throw them in cages and ruin their lives as standard. So this... It's a linguistic intervention, but I think it's one that matters, that if you're going to talk about nonviolence, please understand that it should always be predicated on an understanding of there is no state of nonviolence. That's impossible for that situation. Violence is there, and it's located in the white supremacist power structure, policing, the presence of explicit white supremacists, for example, in Charlottesville. So, yeah, it's a sort of demand for that pre-existing violence to be recognized, and not put the violent turn on those who are trying to stand up to that violence, even with confrontational and destructive at times tactics. So, yeah, that's sort of my argument around that, and also in terms of when people call upon the nonviolent aspects and principled nonviolence of the civil rights movement, it's also really important to remember that that was again predicated on violence, with an understanding of televisual capacity at that time, newness of that, that in certain nonviolent tactics, violence would happen. It would provoke the violence of the police, and that is the violence that these tactics wanted to make clear and make seen. So this idea of non-violence has also to be understood on the predication of pre-existing violence, both in terms of those who maintain non-violent principled tactics and those that don't.
There's an essay in the book about Standing Rock, and I'm curious, for young people that are listening to this now that maybe weren't around during Standing Rock, and are now coming into this climate movement with things like Extinction Rebellion, what would you impart on them, that whole experience?
I mean, I would just sort of urge that people recognize that Indigenous struggle has been fighting this fight and on the front lines of it for many, many, many years. So these are absolutely necessary allegiances in this struggle, and failure to recognize that is a form of neocolonialism and, you know, tacit white supremacy. And it sets up for all kinds of failures, because I think Indigenous struggle really is well versed and well practiced, and crucial in this is an understanding of our mutual implicatedness with how we live together in this world with resources and hold each other through water and life. And I think these have to be both political and, whether you are invested in it or not, understood as kind of spiritual approaches to a struggle that actually very much should be that. And I think, looking to Standing Rock as a kind of site of inspiration, and not thinking the kind of first uprisings in recent years around climate struggle happened with the climate strike or with Extinction Rebellion. Absolutely not. And I think that legacy hopefully will be recognized. And in some sites it is. And I think it's great. Whatever people think of Greta, you know, I think it's great, and great that she's obviously like talking to Indigenous youth who've been fighting this fight this side of the Atlantic. And I think that's important that she's been doing that. And I hope that other climate activists follow that lead and seek inspiration and guidance there.
Awesome. Is there anything else you have on the horizon for yourself in terms of projects or thing you're working on, or is there another book planned at some point?
I mean, one day, but I don't have any ideas yet. I'm in an ideas rut. No, I'm going to keep editing for Commune. I've got my, if you want to see my columnizing, I do that at The Intercept twice a month. I teach at the New School, if you guys want to come to the New School, but also, any time I write something, be it an essay, a column, or a stupid thought, I put it on Twitter, and I'm just Natasha Leonard, you know, that's my handle. So just, if people are interested, that's where to find me.
Yeah, we definitely encourage people to check out your columns on The Intercept. They've been great. Lots of great coverage. Awesome. Anything else you want to say or touch on? Also, if people want to pick up the book after listening to this, where should they go?
So you can just go to versobooks.com, and they've got a great direct services delivery thing, which is great for everywhere.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.